Welcome to the Best of the Left podcast with clips today from The Young Turks, Rachel Maddow, and On the Media.
So we're going to have fun in this hour, and when you talk about fun, of course, you talk about torture. So, on with us is Stephen Miles. He's a doctor, and he's also the author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror. How you doing, Dr. Miles?
Totally cheered up by that. Thanks a lot.
All right. So, look, we've been looking forward to doing this interview for a while, Dr. Miles, because we want to ask you something that's... Something that you mentioned here, I want to get back to what we actually did do in Iraq and Guantanamo Bay, et cetera, that you talk about extensively in the book. But first, tell us, does torture work?
Torture does not work. It's been studied up the wazoo. It's been studied more than most drugs in the United States have. It's been studied by more than 200 studies by the CIA in Project Kubark. It's been studied by the British, the Israelis, and torture does not produce good information.
Why is that? What did the studies conclude?
What the studies show is you find out what you want to hear. For example, we tortured a guy. We took him to Egypt. We tortured him, and he told us that Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda were cooperating on bioweapons. That's what we wanted to hear. We took that to the UN. That became part of the rationale for the going into Iraq, and it wasn't true. We also are sending our guys on, according to one Marine interrogator I talked to recently, he said, we're sending our guys off on these dangerous wild goose chases, chasing down bad information that we've gotten from torture. The other thing that torture does, a different way of not working, is it radicalizes the population that you torture against you. And we've seen that certainly happen in Iraq as well.
Well, Dr. Miles, I disagree with you. According to that story you just gave there, torture does work. We wanted false information so we could invade Iraq, and we got false information so we could invade Iraq out of the wonderful torture that Dick Cheney authorized.
You're a hell of a guy.
Dr. Miles, it seems that all sounds correct, but wouldn't it hold true that someone who did have pertinent, your explanations would work, would seem why torture would not work on somebody who didn't have the information, but wouldn't somebody being tortured at some point pony up the relevant information?
No, that's not true either. That's been studied as well, and I wish it was so. But people who do not want to talk become, in the words of the Army interrogation manual, more sullen and less likely to give up the information the longer that you torture them. One of the things that torture does is it tends to radicalize the person you're torturing, and it ratifies their sense that you are an enemy, and so that they may succumb by releasing a kind of information that is related to but actually quite wrong, such as the wrong date of the plan of an attack.
What about the 24, the television show argument, which has obviously exposed more Americans to torture than that? And by the way, you're talking to two people who love the show but are very curious about its effects on the national psyche regarding torture. What in 24, at the very least, the kind of torture generally exhibited on 24 is your what seems very unlikely to happen in this endless and expanding war on terror is the ticking time bomb theory. There's a girl, she's buried alive, and we have an hour to reach her. We know you're the guy who took her. Tell us where she is. Does that kind of torture work in those rare circumstances?
Well, first off, the police or soldiers rarely know that a person has a specific information that they can obtain from a particular technique that they can immediately act on.
Mm-hmm.
I've looked at every instance which the United States claims they had a ticking time bomb scenario. For example, there was one where they said they tortured this guy who revealed just in time this plot to hijack to put bombs on 8 trans-Pacific airliners and blow them up in flight from the Philippines. In fact, we got information on that plot from his laptop, the data that he supplied by the harsh interrogation was false.
Well, what about, though, I mean, that I understand. I'm talking about, like, it's already happened. The crime is that the bombs are on the plane. We need to know what plane. I realize this is all, this is Hollywood. I don't.
Yeah.
I concede that the likelihood of this happening in real life is unlikely. Jenk and I used to talk about you're a small town sheriff and a girl's been abducted and this sadistic killer is buried or somewhere. Forget whether it's ethical to torture him. Is he likely under torture in that circumstance where you know you got 60 minutes to play with and torturing him after that is irrelevant? Is he likely to reveal relevant information under torture?
You can make up hypotheticals, but for example, the Israeli Supreme Court recently, when they were asked to legalize torture in Israel, they told their security services, look, we're willing to consider this, but you got to come up with some case in your own vast experience of working with prisoners where you have defused a ticking time bomb with torture. And if you do that, then we will take seriously the possibility of legalizing torture in Israel. And the security services could not come up with one case. And so with that, Israel abandoned torture.
So we're talking to Dr. Stephen Miles. He wrote the book Oath Betrayed, Torture and Medical Complicity in the War on Terror.
So, Dr. Miles, you're saying the show 24 is unrealistic. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Yeah, it's TV land.
But I don't get it. I don't get it. Why would they do it? Why would Jack Bauer do torture if it wasn't going to work?
Well, okay. Jack Bauer is selling cereal, but...
No, Dr. Miles, let me ask you a serious question.
Yeah.
You know, if the weight of evidence is on this side, and the military, the United States military believes that and agrees to that, and they counseled Rumsfeld and others to not do this, as we see from inside sources that they did, and, you know, you have the Israeli court saying there's not a single instance of it, et cetera, et cetera. There's this overwhelming evidence. Why do you think they did authorize it? What did they think they were going to get out? Did they just, in their arrogance, feel, oh, they know better than the weight of an entire United States military history?
That is a great question. And what happened, apparently, was this. Rumsfeld set up his own interrogation service inside the Army. He bypassed all of our traditional interrogation experts. The FBI was horrified at what he did. Stansfield Turner, who's a former CIA director, called Cheney the vice president of torture. In fact, the resistance to this is coming from inside the CIA and the highest levels of the FBI, which has told them to stand down and stand back when the Army goes off and does this. And Major General Fay did an investigation of this operation and said that the people who were in charge of implementing this program of harsh interrogation were largely untrained in doing interrogation techniques. They were simply trained in how to apply the Rumsfeld harsh interrogation policy.
We're talking to Dr. Stephen Miles. He's written Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror. Let me ask you, I got a couple questions, but first let me hit on what you just mentioned, the former director of the CIA, Stansfield Turner. He did call Vice President Cheney the Vice President of Torture, but in an interview that I saw that Stansfield Turner did, he acknowledged that under questioning from whoever he was on with, some cable talk show host, that, we have engaged in torture in the past, but Turner said it was significant that when we engaged in the past, it was isolated cases, and it was wrong. We were clearly breaking the law when we did it, and that it's different now to sort of turn that torture to sanction it, if you will, under sort of under the now all of a sudden it's sort of vaguely legal or at the very least confusing.
Yeah, that's correct. And you know, one of the things that we've done here is we've taken down a system of international law that we use to protect dissidents in other countries. We'd go to China, for example, we'd say, you can't treat this person this way because of the Geneva Accords. Now we do this, and what China says is, you've got to be kidding.
Right.
You're preaching at us about the Geneva Accords,
right?
And we've also lost a protection for our own POWs.
Dr. Miles, I ask this question a lot when we have guests on, and it seldom works. So I'm gonna try again.
Please do.
Yeah, thank you very much.
It's like torture doesn't work, but we keep trying it anyway.
Well,
so.
I'm gonna ask you to put yourself in to play essentially devil's advocate with yourself. You've given us Jenk asked and you said it was a terrific question of why Rumsfeld did it. I want to know because when those who argue for this what they would call coercive interrogation techniques, when they argue for torture, they don't just say, "Hey, we got to be tough." they cloud themselves in an argument that I fail to understand or that uses maybe false statistics. What is the argument to torture? Not why did they do it, but what is that argument as best you can understand in writing a book to sort of expose the truth about torture? You must have been exposed to the argument on the other side.
Sure. I think the way to understand torture, and this applies to many events in our own history too that occurred during the Jim Crow period, in the way that police departments have and still treat people from some communities, is that torture basically arises in the context of a society whose politics are blighted by extreme dehumanization. And that once you do that, you create special categories of people who are seen as meriting treatment beneath standard legal rules. And you do that for a number of reasons. First off, you just feel that they flat out don't deserve ordinary humane treatment. But also you feel that because they are dehumanized, the only thing that they'll respond to is radically abusive treatment.
But are there studies that contradict what you are maintaining, that torture does work? Are there, and you obviously would think those studies are wrong or flawed, but is there a counter argument to torture doesn't work?
I went and looked at all the studies of torture that I could find, and of all the studies that I could find, which obviously does not include I presume some studies remain classified,
right?
I can't find any study showing that torture worked. Now, I will say this, that in Algeria fought a war for independence against the French, okay? Mm-hmm. There's a French general who wrote a book called Battle for the Casbah, in which he claimed that by torturing people, he was able to get some information, advanced knowledge of torture or of terrorist attacks. But nevertheless, most historians feel that in the battle for Algerian independence, the use of torture by the French radicalized the Algerian people against the French. And so whatever tactical advances were made in a couple cases, if they happened, and nobody's been
right.
able to confirm what this general said, they were more than offset by the strategic loss of a radicalized Algerian population.
And you would also maintain that in a given case where torture might work, you're going to have 10 cases where it doesn't work, and it's going to send you in the wrong direction anyway.
Well, that's it. And also, you have to remember that on the prisoners in Iraq, for example, by the Army's intelligence's own assessment, somewhere around 85% of those patients are ignorant or innocent of all al-Qaeda or insurgency engagement.
Right. Well.
Well, you know, but sometimes, have you seen any studies that show when you torture innocent people that you get wonderful results from it?
What about those studies? Yeah.
If you torture innocent people, they will tell you their address.
Look, you know, my common sense tells me, just to round that portion of it up, and we're running short on time here, but my common sense tells me is, look, in some cases, clearly, if the guy is guilty, he's going to feel the pain, and he's going to tell you, where the body's buried or where the bomb is ticking or whatever it is. But it appears that the large studies show that is a rare amount of the cases, and that most of the time they give you misleading information, and when you put together the fact that they also radicalizes the population against you, it winds up being grotesquely counterproductive for whatever small advantages you might gain in the rare instances that you might have the guilty person and that it might work.
Yeah, well, another way of putting it, though, would be that what torture does is it induces the innocent to confess to anything and the hardened criminals to resist you. And so that actually it pulls information out of the wrong people.
Right. That's a great way of putting it, too. Real quick, last question for you, Dr. Miles. And Dr. Miles wrote the book, Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity, and the War on Terror. Let's talk about that medical complicity. Do you think that some of the doctors that worked with the United States military violated their oaths and did the wrong thing here by working with them?
Docs are frontline human rights monitors. They are there in prisons where the Red Cross never gets to. If they didn't see the abuses themselves, they saw the signs of the abuses. The docs were silent to the degree to allow this system of abuse to persist over a 2.5 to 3 year period before it finally became disclosed.
So they should have stepped up and they should have talked, and instead they didn't, probably just to protect their jobs.
That's basically right.
All right. Dr. Stephen Miles, author of Oath Betrayed, thank you so much for joining us on the Young Turks.
Yeah, thank you, Doctor.
Thanks.
By essentially a unanimous vote, the U.S. Congress passed a bill, and the president signed it, called the War Crimes Act, the War Crimes Act of 1996. This law says that the U.S. government will prosecute war crimes committed by or committed against any American. The man who was instrumental in getting the War Crimes Act passed in the U.S. Congress is a retired Navy pilot named Michael Cronin. He fought in the Vietnam War. He spent 6 years as a prisoner of war in the so-called Hanoi Hilton. This is a man who knows a thing or two about war crimes. Mike Cronin joins us on the phone from Massachusetts this morning. Mr. Cronin, thanks very much for coming on the show today.
Happy to do it. Good morning.
Good morning. What led you to get involved in lobbying for the War Crimes Act in the 90s?
Well, I went to law school late in life. I have been working as an airline pilot, and of course, as an airline pilot, any day can be your last day at work. And I was concerned about what I might do in later years if my company ran into trouble. So I went to law school at night, and while there, since I had been a prisoner of war, I did some research on war crimes and the prosecution of war crimes. My nightmare was that what if I ran into a North Vietnamese who had been working in the Hanoi Hilton, who had somehow managed to get into the United States as a refugee or whatever, and I recognized him, and what would the law say about that situation? And the answer was, nothing. He would walk. Hmm. And so I made it my goal to change that, and I wrote some papers on it while I was in law school. And later on, when I was working on Capitol Hill representing my fellow pilots before Congress, I made it my private goal to find somebody who would work on that legislation with me. And that's when I met Congressman Walter Jones of North Carolina, who introduced legislation in the House, and the rest is history. The law did eventually pass.
What's interesting, too, is that, I mean, when the U.S. signed, ratified the Geneva Conventions, which was in the 50s, right?
Yes, 1956.
1956.
Geneva Conventions are the 1949 Geneva Conventions. They're ratified by the United States Senate in 1956.
And when every state that ratifies them was supposed to pass a domestic law that would, obligated by having ratified the Geneva Convention to pass a domestic law that makes them enforceable. But until you started lobbying for this, the U.S. had gone 40 years without ever doing it.
Yes, and I did a lot of research on that, and when the Senate was considering ratification, Attorney General Brownell, working under President Eisenhower, testified before the Senate that there would be no constitutional reason why the United States could not pass such legislation. The senators were concerned about that. So then there was a discussion in committee, but no legislation was ever introduced, and the subject never came up again until I brought it up. In fact, the hardest thing I had to do in working for the legislation was to convince people that there wasn't already a law, because the first thing that came into their mind was the Nuremberg Tribunals.
Yeah.
And you had to explain to them, well, we couldn't hold those tribunals today. It's a wholly different situation.
Wow. And the thing that has become controversial very recently about this law that passed in 1996 is that what it did was it granted U.S. courts the authority to convict any foreigner who committed a war crime against an American, but it also said that Americans can be convicted of war crimes if they violate the Geneva Conventions. And the way that it's written, does that mean any American anywhere, whether or not they're on U.S. soil or whether or not they're a member of the military, does it matter? Does it say?
No, it does not say, and that was very early in our discussions with the people who actually drafted the legislation for Congressman Jones. There was a concern. Well, you know, we can't write a one-sided law. It has to be two-sided to those Americans who commit crimes and to Americans who are victims of crime. And I said, well, you can't really object to that, can you? And so that we went ahead with that, and of course, people who are serving in our military are already subject to the UCMJ and would have been punished for committing war crimes under UCMJ even before this law was passed.
UCMJ is the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the military justice system, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And that was one of the reasons why people said, well, why do we need this? We have the UCMJ. And, well, what about some other people? And if a U.S. serviceman is released from service, once he's released from service, the UCMJ loses jurisdiction. So there are various reasons why the law closes some major gaps, primarily against war criminals who victimize Americans, but the other way as well.
Right. And so the reason that this is being raised again and being attempted at least to be revisited by the Bush administration right now is because clearly they're worried that U.S. servicemen who have left the services, people who are acting on behalf of the United States but aren't in the military, people, for example, who work for the CIA or who are interrogators, or people in the civilian chain of command who order things that are found to be war crimes, who order people in the military or other parts of the government to commit something that is viewed to be a war crime, that those people should be prosecuted under this law. And that's after the Supreme Court ruled that you can't exempt people from the Geneva Conventions. That's freaking them out that people in the administration and in the chain of command under Bush will find themselves subjected to these prosecutions.
That's correct. In fact, if you read the internal memos, which have now been released and you can find them on the internet, that the administration used in their internal debate on how to handle the detainees, the War Crimes Act was one of their concerns from the beginning, and it's one of the main reasons why they attempted to classify these people as being exempt from the Geneva Conventions, because they didn't want the War Crimes Act to apply to themselves or anybody below them.
They were already thinking about that in 2002 when they said, oh, by the way, Geneva doesn't apply.
Yes. That was one of the factors that led them to that decision.
It's hard for me as an American to swallow the idea that my government recognized that it was probably violating something called the War Crimes Act and already making plans in advance to squirrel out of it as early as 2002. I mean, I don't. I'm curious as to how you feel about the efforts right now by the Bush administration to try to soften up this act or change the statutory interpretation of it, given that you were so instrumental in getting it passed in the first place.
Well, I wouldn't want to see it softened, but what is perhaps useful, in fact, definitely useful, is to make it more specific. Right now, the way the act was written, on the advice of the staffers who were working on it in Congress at the time, it's very general. It simply says the Geneva Conventions apply, and those who violate them and other laws of war are subject to prosecution. Well, one of the administration concerns, which is legitimate, is, well, what exactly are we talking about? What crimes? I think the dialogue that's going on now in Congress, there was a hearing yesterday before the Senate Armed Forces Committee, and the subject was raised extensively. Okay, what exactly are we talking about? We need to flesh out this law and make it more specific. Of course, there is room for mischief there. They could try to exempt themselves from things that they've done in the past or what have you. But there is also a very useful dialogue that's going on.
Do you ever feel like the issue of the vagueness of the Geneva Conventions has ever been a problem for the United States before this current fight, before this current Justice Department in particular? It seems to me like that's not been a major international concern until all of a sudden we've decided that that fighting terrorism is unworkable unless we nail down all these things that have never needed to be nailed down before.
Well, yes, that's true, but here's why it's true. our opponents on the battlefield have never honored the Geneva Conventions, so
sure.
It isn't a matter of specificity and nuts and bolts. It's a matter of they simply refuse to apply them. That was the case in North Vietnam. North Vietnam also being a signatory of the Geneva Conventions, they simply said, well, no, it doesn't apply to you. You're a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
But now, because we are a very legalistic society and these things will wind up passing through our courts, there is legitimate concern. We have to have some nuts and bolts here. What exactly does this mean? What does that mean? Define torture. What is degrading treatment? You know, some of these other terms, there might not be an adequate trail of cases which would enable a judge to decide, well, has there been a crime committed here or not?
Yeah. I mean,
There's room for mischief in this discussion, but it's also a useful discussion.
The thing that's so hard for me is not to accept that the people who are fighting are not following the Geneva Conventions. It's that we might be choosing not to follow the Geneva Conventions. They've been trying to declare that they don't apply and now trying to make sure that they're not held liable for violations of them. I see it as a very troubling development. I'm grateful to you for talking to us about it today and also for your work to get this law put on the books in the first place. Thanks, Mr. Cronin.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. I'll be happy to speak to you anytime.
Thank you very much. Michael Cronin is a retired Navy pilot. He was shot down over Vietnam in 1967. He spent 6 years in the Hanoi Hilton. He himself was a victim of war crimes. He was tortured in the Hanoi Hilton. When he came back and went to law school later in life, he's the man who lobbied, a one-man band lobbying to get the 1996 War Crimes Act put on the books in U.S. statutes. The Justice Department under President Bush right now trying to change the statutory interpretation of that, in my analysis, because they want to make sure that they don't get prosecuted for war crimes for violating Geneva.
The legal landscape is still feeling the aftershocks of the disclosure last December of a vast National Security Agency domestic wiretapping program. More than 20 lawsuits have been working their way through the courts, and the government has often defended itself with the most reliable weapon in its arsenal, the state secrets privilege. Essentially, that's when the government claims that it would have to reveal state secrets if the case went to trial. That handy tactic has shut down many, many cases against the government since 9/11. So it came as a surprise last week when a San Francisco judge rejected the state secrets privilege and ruled that a case against the government and AT&T related to NSA wiretapping could go forward. Jonathan Turley is a professor of public interest law at George Washington University and a lead counsel in a federal case looking into the NSA program. He says that until now, the state secrets privilege has served the government as an almost impenetrable shield from legal scrutiny, wielded in ways its creators never intended.
You know, the Supreme Court said that not all classified matters should be subject to this privilege. This was supposed to be a very exceptional thing to dismiss a case on this basis.
Now, a case was dismissed in Chicago on Tuesday because of the state secrets privilege, but surprisingly, as we mentioned, the privilege didn't work in San Francisco. So what happened?
It really was the factor of the judges. You have a judge in San Francisco that said, look, I just don't buy your argument that simply forcing these telecom companies to confirm or deny whether they gave you a lot of information would bring the republic to its knees. The judge in Chicago adopted a much more deferential view to the government and, frankly, a view that's more consistent with other courts. He just simply said, look, I have this declaration that says that national security would be injured. He seemed to indicate that he wasn't quite confident of that, but said that he had to go along with what the administration said.
So let's talk about another case, the Supreme Court decision on Hamdan, which found that the government did not have the right to try Guantanamo detainees in secret military tribunals. You say that this decision has the effect of bolstering all the cases now pending against the NSA wiretapping program. Why?
Well, the administration has been arguing for years now that when they were given authority by Congress after 9/11 to go after the perpetrators of that, that it gave the president absolute authority in eavesdropping and handling of detainees and enemy combatants. And many of us have questioned that and said, that's just not the case. This is a very narrowly defined resolution. And in fact, the senators rejected broader language. Well, it still gave them an argument. They could say, people can disagree, but this is the authority that we believe is clear. Well, the Supreme Court rejected that and refused to read into it this type of broad authority. Now, when it did that in Hamdan, it virtually cut away the legal claims used to defend the NSA operation. Now, what that means is hard to overstate, because some of us believe that the president committed a federal crime when he ordered not once but 30 times the renewal of this program.
So into this patchwork of legal cases working their way through our courts enters Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He said in an op-ed in Monday's Washington Post that the surveillance program was, quote, a festering sore on our body politic, and said that he held fierce, torturous negotiations with the president and came out with a major breakthrough. You don't think so?
The Specter-Cheney compromise would remove these cases challenging the NSA operation to a secret court called the FISA court. This secret court was designed to approve warrants for searches. It's like taking Marbury versus Madison and sending it to a traffic court. It is absolutely preposterous to send a massive constitutional case to that court where opposing counsel is not allowed in the courtroom. So the government doesn't have any opposing counsel. If the government wins, no one can take an appeal. And moreover, Specter would allow the government unlimited chances to tweak the program until it passes review in the secret proceeding.
But Specter's justification, as I read it, is that if all these cases were to proceed in court, the government would invoke things like the state secrets privilege, and basically they would be shut down anyway. So at least this way, the president has a place where he can feel comfortable being scrutinized.
Well, the problem with Specter's defense is that this is a case where the so-called do-nothing Congress actually should do nothing, because you have various cases that are very close to a final opinion on the legality of the NSA operation. What the White House, what they fear, is that now that the Supreme Court cut away their legal authority, they may be looking at a public opinion that says the President of the United States has violated federal law. Specter takes great pride in the fact that he was able to get the president to agree that he could be subject to some form of review. The interesting thing is that the Specter bill doesn't actually require the president to do it. It just says the president can do it. Well, you know what? In our system, he doesn't get to choose. These programs are already being reviewed by the courts.
Specter wrote that without knowing the exact contours of the NSA program, it's impossible to say whether the president is right or wrong when it comes to his authority, but that three federal appeals court decisions suggest that the president may be right.
What's he talking about? Are the courts tending towards this expansion of presidential authority or against it?
No, those are decisions that spoke very generally about the president's inherent authority. But most of us do not believe that those are either controlling or in some cases relevant. I think what Senator Spector is trying to do is to say, I really didn't get snookered as much as people think I did. We could lose this. Well, you know, it's a very telling thing when not a single attorney involved in any of this litigation thinks that this is a good idea. All of them, as far as I know, have denounced it as a terrible mutation of our system. Part of our constitutional system requires a certain leap of faith. You don't know if you're going to win, but there's only one rule that is absolutely essential in a Madisonian democracy, and that is you let the federal courts decide. Sometimes you don't win, but you don't create secret courts where there's no opposing counsel and no meaningful appeal. That's not the rule of law. And I think the reason the White House wants this so desperately is that they're afraid that finally a court is going to say what many experts have said, that the president didn't have the authority and that he may have committed a crime over 30 times. And then people like Senator Spector are going to face questions of, why didn't you ever investigate whether the president committed crimes? And what have you been doing for the last few years?
All right. Jonathan, thank you very much.
It's my great pleasure.
Jonathan Turley is a professor of public interest law at George Washington University.
Still obscured by the city, but towers of glass reflected your coming. Silhouetted on the sunrise, did I blink as I watched? Did I close my eyes?
Nick Bichinich, who is the director and producer of Shadow Company, joins us now. Nick, how you doing, man?
How you doing? Hey.
Pretty good, pretty good.
You guys actually just premiered in D.C. last night?
Yes, we did, actually. Well, is that last night? You know what? The time zone has a funny way of playing with my sense of where I am. Yes, it was. It was, in fact, Tuesday night. We had a screening on Tuesday at the E Street Theater, and we also had another one on Capitol Hill, which was, well, fascinating for me. I'd never been inside those buildings. And we had an interesting time with a number of different members of Congress and Senate.
Hmm, interesting. Nick, listen, I got to ask you 17 different questions, but first we got to set up what this documentary is for people. When you say documentary, of course, some people zone out and they, you know, and I was a little concerned about, is it going to be dry? Then I saw the trailer and knocked my socks off. It's a badass trailer you got here. And shoot, we're a video show too, and it's perfect because it's all audio as well. You could totally understand it on the radio. Let's play the trailer for everybody for Shadow Company and then come back and talk about it.
Cool.
All right, here we go.
Broadcasting from an undisclosed location, Freedom Radio on 107.7 FM, Baghdad.
For those of you who don't already know, I quit the job at the law firm and I'm now working for a private security company in Iraq. I'm on a 6-on, 3-off rotation, 6 weeks on, 3 weeks off. The contract is huge. 200 men doing close protection tasks, or PSD as the Americans call it. There are swarms of other firms of private contractors all over the place. Some complete cowboy outfits. But this one is fairly sharp, so I'm not too worried about getting killed. I'm currently tasked to the Baghdad office working out of a villa in the Green Zone, where the CPA, that's the Coalition Provisional Authority, has set up shop. The city on the whole was in ruins, but it doesn't seem all that dangerous right now.
Allahu Akbar!
George Bush has created the ultimate Wild West scenario in Iraq. If you've got a gun and you're for hire, his work for it.
A mercenary is somebody who goes and fights and gets paid for it.
Private military firms are the corporate evolution of the age-old mercenary trade.
If someone wants to go and overthrow a despot government, they're going to be hard pushed to get the right type of guys, because most of those guys are actually working in Iraq.
You put civilian contractors, guns, drugs, diamonds, arms embargoes, and gold in the same scenario, you can mix that up into quite a nice little recipe for a disaster.
The CPA specifically stated that contractors don't fall under Iraqi law.
If you look at it from the Iraqi point of view, that means that contractors can operate with impunity.
I would not work for a criminal entity, and obviously that it's my call whether that entity is criminal or not.
You tell people, yell, inch it, you know, back. If they don't see the gun...
You may have to make contact with that vehicle to let it know that it needs to move out of the way.
If they don't stop, then the second burst goes into the engine. If they continue to come, then the third one goes into the driver.
Did you hit his car or just shoot in front of him?
I shot in front of him. It may have fucking ricocheted and hit his car, but...
I do nothing different than does anybody when they go work for IBM or any other corporation in the world. Is that corporation doing a service or a disservice to society? And if you believe they're doing a disservice and you still work for them, what does that make you?
Well, there you have it. It's Shadow Company, and it's certainly got plenty of action in it. But there are a great number of issues that arise out of that. We're talking to the producer and director, Nick Pashinich. Nick, first of all, how many private military contractors do we have in Iraq right now, the United States?
It's a fascinating question, and the simple answer is that no one really knows, and it's one of the key questions that we raise in this documentary. The Department of Defense has quoted the figure of 20,000. The real figure, on the basis of the people that I've spoken to, I believe is much closer to 70,000. So they're the second largest partner in the coalition. There is no other country that provides more troops than the private sector does, with the exception of the U.S.
So when you say the private sector, are they all from the United States, or actually are these soldiers, these private soldiers, from all over the world?
The private soldiers are from all over the world. There is a number of them that are American. There's a number that come from other modern Western armies. For example, there will be Brits there. There will be Germans. There will be South Africans. But sure, there's a significant number of them that come from the U.S. There's the overwhelming number of companies that are out there are either U.S.-owned or U.K.-owned. But even the U.S. companies can draw their employees from varying different nations.
So how do... I'm sorry, Mark. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, as a follow-up to that then, and I know, as Cenk mentions, there are a lot of different questions that are opened in the film, and I know that you address in the film different issues. But from an operational standpoint then, having said what you've just said, what rules and regulations that are sort of military rules and regs do these private armies have to follow, if any? In other words, when you see if it's a private army guy, does he have to sort of answer to the same rules and regs as the federal army guy?
It's a very interesting question. You know, the question is, I mean, we can expand on that even further and say, do they even have to follow their chain of command? You know, what happens if you're mixing private individuals who, yes, they're experienced soldiers, but they're essentially private individuals that are carrying weapons in a conflict zone, and you're a military commander? You know that you can tell X amount of the guys who are underneath you in your chain of command what to do, but can you tell these private guys what to do? Do you even know? The answer is it's not 100% clear. It appears that we are kind of learning as we go along. So, yes, there are certain aspects of rules that have been developed that apply to these individuals, but it's definitely not something that's known about. You know, for example, what is known about is that local laws in Iraq do not apply to these individuals. So, while I'm not suggesting for a second that they go around and shoot at civilians indiscriminately, the fact that they could and they could not be prosecuted under local law is an exceptionally dangerous thing. Like I said, they don't do that. That's not something they do. They are very professional soldiers by and large. But it's an exceptionally interesting environment when you're sticking a profit-motivated corporation into the business of war in this way, especially when that profit-motivated corporation doesn't just, you know, collect garbage or deliver food, but actually has guys that carry guns in that environment.
We're talking to Nick. He is the director and producer of Shadow Company. Did a documentary about this. Nick, there's two obvious follow-up questions here. One is, in the military chain of command, if you don't follow orders, you're going to go to the brig and you're going to get court-martialed.
Mm-hmm.
Here, obviously, there is no court-martial. If, you know, let's say that Mark is the general of the Young Turks here, and he tells JR to do something, and if he doesn't do it, we don't send JR to jail. Worst case scenario is, okay, JR doesn't work here anymore. So for those guys, if they go and do something, you know, that their quote-unquote, you know, boss is telling them not to do, that's a sad day for the boss, isn't it? And I mean, they could just...
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, there's a number of different arguments you can use here. For example, if you talk to the private military sector or their lobby group happens to be called the International Peace Operators Association.
Ironic.
Exactly, ironic. It's yet another funny thing. So then you've got mercenary, you've got soldier of fortune, you've got private security contractor, private military contractor, and now suddenly you have peace operator as well. If you talk to those guys, they'll throw acronyms at you. They'll say, oh, but, you know, the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act applies, or the Uniform Code of Military Justice is probably going to apply. The fact is, these guys welcome regulation, but it's not entirely clear. Even if you have put this regulation into place, as one of the people who we interviewed in the documentary in Shadow Company says, regulation doesn't really do a good job of preventing abuses. Regulation just makes it possible to prosecute the abuses once they happen.
So Let me interrupt you to ask that then. Has any of these private contractors, the tens of thousands that have been there for now 3 years, have any of them been prosecuted for anything? And under what law were they prosecuted?
Not a single one.
Not one. Out of the 20,000 to 70,000 that were there for 3 years, not one ever broke any law, even though they're firing all the time.
Right. That's absurd on its face, is the point. Right.
Exactly. I mean, you know, as you pointed out, it's highly likely that some laws were broken. How serious those laws were, nobody really knows. And in the fog of war, you would imagine that some of the laws that were broken kind of, you know, they go along with the territory. Like, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. But the point is, we need to set up one of the reasons why we made this is because we felt that the rules of war were changing right under us. And if people didn't know more about who these guys were, what they did, and why, it's a very dangerous and slippery slope, because at some point we just won't really have any understanding of who's fighting the wars for us. You know, and if the private sector takes on that kind of role, if the monopoly of the use of force is no longer in the nation state, well, we've got a very interesting scenario, and I don't think a lot of people are ready for it.
We're talking to Nick Pachinich. He is the producer and director of Shadow Company, a documentary about these private military contractors that we're using in Iraq, anywhere from 20,000 to 70,000 of them. Nick, let me bring up two bad case scenarios here. One is, let's say, you know, we finally get out of Iraq and we decide to not invade Iran, which would be a relief. And we're done with most of the wars in the Middle East. Now, here you have, let's use the number 50,000, just pick a number in the middle. Here you have an army of 50,000 guys who are used to getting paid, and paid handsomely, to conduct warfare. Is there any chance that they would then go work for other people who would be in the market for such warriors? Maybe a warlord in Africa, or perhaps one in Afghanistan, or perhaps in Central Asia. Is there a concern that this could get out of control and that we would have a private army that is basically for hire?
This is one of the traditional concerns with the use of private soldiers for hire. This has happened in the past. I mean, there is a historical precedent. You know, during the medieval wars between England and France, what happened is there were so many English soldiers left around in Europe when the war eventually ended that they self-organized into these roving companies called the Free Companies, and they went around and essentially were hiring themselves out to the highest bidder. So it's often convenient for people to point at that and say, well, you know, this could really happen. Realistically, I think it's highly unlikely. It's certainly something that's conceivable, but the caliber of professionalism that's involved in these private military companies today makes it, in my opinion, and again, you know, I'm just a filmmaker here. One of the things I'm trying to do is raise a lot of questions rather than provide convenient answers for them. I think it's highly unlikely that significantly unethical decisions will be made by these companies simply because it's not good business. You know, these companies have become multi-million-dollar organizations. If they make one really bad move, they're highly unlikely to be allowed to make another good move again, because they'll be.
Nick, let me look. You did the documentary. You know the facts, but that's never stopped me before. Let me disagree with you, and I'll tell you why. Number one, that's all fine and good. Their reputation's on the line, but if there's no wars, then they're not in business anyway. They gotta, you know, these guys are in the business of war. So somebody's got to hire them. I mean, if we're in a permanent state of war here in the United States and we're constantly using private companies, then yes, your argument is perfectly logical. But if we're out of the business of war, roughly speaking, then they're going to need to get hired by somebody. But second of all, and more importantly, I think, sure, Blackwater doesn't want to get hired by Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, warlord in Afghanistan, to fight against, you know, Karzai, who's backed by the U.S., for example. But now that they're all out of business, maybe not all 50,000, but he can't put together 500 people, 2,000 people who used to work for Blackwater and that are now unemployed and whose main job is to get paid to fight wars, you think that's not possible?
Oh, no. I think that's completely possible. I just don't. I think it's something that very quickly transcends the corporate structures. What you're essentially getting at is, if we have a huge amount of unemployed professional soldiers, does it mean that all sorts of daring do can happen? Well, you know, the answer is obviously yes. We only need to look back as far as Margaret Thatcher's son, Mark Thatcher's financial involvement in the attempted overthrow of Equatorial Guinea, which happened in late 2004. You know, here's a scenario in which guys who were working as private security contractors in Iraq, at least, I mean, it's very little exact detail is known about who these guys were, but what is known is at least three of the individuals that were on the plane that were arrested as mercenaries in Zimbabwe, they were en route to Equatorial Guinea to attempt an overthrow of the country, had previously, as recently as 3 months before that point, worked as private security contractors in Iraq. So the fact is, there are numerous unscrupulous individuals in this field who will work for whatever's going. I would say, however, that on the basis of the people that I met, one of the things that was fascinating to me is the overwhelming majority had a very strong head on their shoulders, and they were not the stereotypical mercenaries that many media would have you imagine. And that was certainly one of the things that we tried to get across in this piece. We tried to make a very balanced portrayal of who these guys were, as opposed to jump on the stereotypes and say, oh, my God, this is all evil. It should be destroyed.
We're talking to Nick Bocinich. He is the director of Shadow Company. It's a documentary about these private contractors, or otherwise known as mercenaries, in Iraq. Let me ask you a different question real quick. So when we say we have 130,000 troops in Iraq, that number is totally wrong. The reality is we have, you know, in your estimation, nearly 200,000 soldiers. Just 130,000 happen to be actual government-paid soldiers, and 70,000 happen to be private soldiers in Iraq.
Yeah, it's a very interesting way of looking at it. I mean, you know, many would argue that the idea of the U.S. government outsourcing aspects of the pointy bit of warfare, in other words, the weapon-carrying stuff, is essentially a straightforward example of foreign policy by proxy. You know, when you do something like that, yes, technically speaking, they don't fall under the U.S. Army, so they don't have to be counted as troops. Technically speaking, George Bush doesn't have to go out and meet the flag-covered coffins of the guys that die if they're private military contractors. But the fact is, a lot of the Americans that are out there that are working in these private positions see themselves as a logical extension of the U.S. Army, and they have the same ideology.
And finally, do you have a number or an idea of a number of those from the private army that have died or have been injured?
Yes, there are only semi-official figures on this. The last time I looked into the figures was about 6 months ago, and the number was 275.
Okay, so that would add to our official body count as well, but it's not in our official body count.
No,
you say 2,500 some odd kids, U.S. soldiers, have died in Iraq, but in reality, it's actually 2,800 or so if you add the private contractors.
Not all of the 250 are Americans, but yes, your point is still valid.
Right, okay.
I would like to say one more thing, though, which is something you said at the beginning, which is about documentaries and how they're traditionally done. One key thing for me with making this film was that I wanted to make a documentary that I wanted to watch. You know, you watch these documentaries, and I often am guilty of this myself, is I watch these documentaries and, you know, you hear the voice in a voiceover, and it's like, in 1965, the second time the lions crossed into the Kalahari, and you fall asleep. You know, no one wants to see that sort of stuff. So it was very important for me to make something that was entertaining as well as educational. And it certainly seems to have, you know, caught a lot of people's attention, including yourselves. When you watch the trailer, you want to see this kind of information presented in this way. So we wanted to make something modern, and we've ended up electing to self-distribute the DVD at this stage. So www.shadowcompany.com is where people can both see the trailer and find out about how to order the DVD.
So shadowcompany.com.
Shadowcompany.com.
All right. And, Nick, thank you so much for joining us. We could do a whole other interview on your background, and maybe we will one day. But we're out of time today. Thanks again.
This podcast is a member of the Progressive Podcast Network. If you like what you hear, go on over to newmediarevolution.org, where you'll find other like-minded podcasts and soon blogs and vlogs. Progressive Podcast Network at newmediarevolution.org. Variety is the spice of life.